Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, and the time now is just 11 o'clock. Coming up this morning on The Boo, the next show is Radio Zine, which presents letters and politics with the declassified story of the FBI and the weather underground. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support. To keep informed and get involved, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member. And now stay tuned for Radio Zine.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present the live broadcast for the 26th annual Good in the Hood Multicultural Music, Arts, and Food Festival. This three-day celebration kicks off Friday, June 22nd, with the Good in the Hood Parade and Festival continuing Saturday, June 23rd, and ending Sunday evening, June 24th. Good in the Hood is back at King School Park at Northeast Grand Avenue. Tune into KBOO starting Saturday afternoon on June 23rd for the live broadcast. More information about Good in the Hood can be found on the kboo.fm website on the home page.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics. On today's show,
what is simply amazing is this document from August says everything has turned out exactly as we wanted. SDS
is
split.
The FBI.
Yes.
The FBI says this is how this, we wanted.
Yes.
You found that document.
Yes.
You know who wrote it?
The one we have is from the special agent in charge in Cleveland, who was boasting about what they had done, what his guys had done in going to Chicago and playing a part in splitting SDS in half. Half going to progressive labor, traditional Marxist-Leninists, and the other half going to weathermen who were much more countercultural.
Arthur Eckstein spent years reading declassified documents from the FBI about its investigation into the radical 1970s revolutionary group, the Weather Underground. He joins us for the hour to talk about what he found and to retell this story that includes bombings of the U.S. Capitol, the Pentagon, and the State Department. He is the author of the book, Bad Moon Rising, How the Weather Underground Beat the FBI and Lost the Revolution. He joins us next on Letters on Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan says he doesn't support separating immigrant children and parents at the border, but Ryan blamed a court ruling that set minimum standards for the detention of children.
This is because of a court ruling. And so this, I do think, ought to be addressed. We believe it should be addressed in immigration legislation. So what's happening at the border and the separation of parents and their children is because of a court ruling. That's why I think legislation is necessary.
Despite Ryan's remarks blaming a 1997 ruling, the practice of separating immigrant children and parents ramped up after Attorney General Jeff Sessions last month announced a new zero-tolerance policy. Democratic House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi called the Trump administration separation policy barbaric.
Think of the stress of these children. They take a baby away from a nursing mother. They tell someone you're going to give the baby a shower or a bath, and then they take the baby, put them in a car seat, and drive them away. This is not normal. In fact, it's barbaric. It has to stop.
Yesterday, congressional Democrats blocked the entrance to Customs and Border Protection headquarters in Washington, D.C. to protest the Trump administration policy. Arizona's Raul Grijalva was among them. His remarks appeared on his Facebook page.
It is abhorrent to separate moms from their kids. This is abusive against women. It's abusive against children. And do not follow the asylum law. This is not us. This is not America. And it's got to change.
Arizona's Raul Grijalva. Dozens of protests are planned across the country today as part of the Families Belong Together movement. A lawsuit filed by New York's attorney general says Donald Trump used his charitable foundation to settle personal business disputes and bolster his political image with donations directed by his staff. The lawsuit accuses the charity and the Trump family of sweeping violations of campaign finance laws, self-dealing, and illegal coordination with Trump's presidential campaign. New York Attorney General Barbara Underwood said the Donald J. Trump Foundation was little more than a checkbook for payments from Mr. Trump or his businesses to nonprofits, regardless of their purpose or legality. Underwood sued to dissolve the foundation and seek $2.8 million in restitution. The suit also seeks to bar Trump and three of his children, Donald Jr., Ivanka, and Eric, from serving on nonprofit organizations in New York. The lawsuit says the foundation illegally helped support the Trump presidential campaign by raising money at a nationally televised fundraiser in January of 2016, then allowing campaign staffers to dictate how the money was spent in grants. In a couple of tweets, Trump called the case ridiculous and said he would not settle the lawsuit. Donald Trump Jr. said on Fox this morning he would advise his father to refuse to sit for an interview with special counsel Robert Mueller.
I wouldn't do it. I think it'd be stupid. I don't think any proper lawyer would say, hey, you should go do it, because it's not about collusion anymore. It's, can we get him to say something that may be interpreted as somewhat off or inaccurate, and after 50,000 questions, maybe you make a mistake, and that's how we get you.
Sir.
And that's ridiculous.
Trump's attorney Rudy Giuliani said last week he still hopes he can reach agreeable conditions for Trump to be interviewed by Mueller's team, but is increasingly doubtful that will happen. If Trump refuses, Mueller could subpoena him, setting off a legal battle likely to end up at the U.S. Supreme Court. The Justice Department's internal watchdog has released its much-anticipated report on the FBI handling of the Hillary Clinton email investigation. It's the culmination of an 18-month review of one of the most consequential FBI investigations in recent history. CNN reports that the watchdog found Comey violated FBI norms on the Clinton probe, but was not politically motivated. The findings are sure to revive the debate about whether FBI actions affected the outcome of the 2016 presidential election and contributed to Clinton's loss to Donald Trump. Among the actions scrutinized is the fired FBI Director James Comey's decision to publicly announce his recommendation against prosecuting Clinton and his disclosure to Congress days before the election that the investigation was being revived because of newly discovered emails. Democrats, including Clinton, have said Comey's announcement contributed to her defeat. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo worked to present a united front with South Korea and Japan following President Trump's summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Pompeo spoke after talks in the South Korean capital with President Moon Jae-in and the Japanese foreign minister, and in Beijing with Chinese officials.
Japan, the Republic of Korea, now China have all acknowledged that we have turned the corner, that we have begun a process away from the threat of war and towards peace on the peninsula. Each of those three countries, too, has acknowledged the importance of the work that President Trump has undertaken and the commitments that Chairman Kim has made towards that very end to achieve that denuclearization.
Pompeo said Trump's disputed claim that the North's nuclear threat was over was issued with eyes wide open. He brushed off a North Korean state media report suggesting Trump would grant concessions before the North fully rids itself of nuclear weapons. The lower house of Argentina's Congress has approved a highly contested bill that would legalize abortion in the first 14 weeks of pregnancy, sending the measure to the Senate. President Mauricio Macri has said he'll sign the bill if it's approved. The measure has roused fierce passions in the homeland of Pope Francis, with the Catholic Church strongly opposing it. The margin of victory was narrow, 129 to 123, and came after nearly 24 hours of debate. Hundreds of supporters and opponents of the measure watched the debate on large screens set up outside Congress.
70% of society today is in favor of the legalization of abortion, and there's also a social mobilization supporting it. That doesn't necessarily correlate with our representatives in the House of Deputies, but well, we believe that it's precisely in moments like this that the deputies must look to the public and not look inwardly nor religiously.
Argentina now allows abortion only in cases of rape or risk to the health of the pregnant woman. The United Nations General Assembly approved a Palestinian-backed resolution blaming Israel for violence in Gaza and deploring its excessive use of force. The vote was 120-8 with 45 abstentions. Palestinian Ambassador Riyad Mansour.
As the occupation intensifies in its brutality, witnessed every single day in the oppression, intimidation, and humiliation of Palestinian men, women, and children by the Israeli occupying forces and extremist settlers, and as the dangerous political impasse persists, the need to protect our people under this occupation remains urgent and unquestionable.
A key provision asks UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres to recommend an international protection mechanism for occupied Palestinian territory. The final vote came after the UN General Assembly narrowly rejected a U.S. demand to add a condemnation of attacks on Israel by Hamas. The General Assembly text did condemn the firing of rockets from Gaza into Israeli civilian areas. Since near-weekly mass protests began March 30th along the Israel-Gaza border, more than 120 Palestinians have been killed and over 3,800 wounded by Israeli snipers. Some have thrown rocks or flown flaming kites that they've dropped into Israel. None has opened fire on Israeli soldiers. The U.S. Supreme Court has struck down a Minnesota law that restricted what voters can wear to the polls. The justices ruled the law violates the First Amendment. Still, the justices' 7-2 ruling suggested some restrictions on what people can wear while they vote are permissible. I'm Eileen Alfandary. Letters and Politics is next.
Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. In about an hour from now, the Department of Justice Inspector General is scheduled to release his long-anticipated report on the FBI's investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails while she was Secretary of State, and also other issues, including alleged political bias within the FBI against the Donald Trump presidential candidacy. This show airs at different times around the country. It first airs live at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern time. So depending where you are, you may be hearing this after the report becomes public. But if you're in California, we're still about an hour from that report being released. So that all said, the Washington Post is reporting that the Inspector General's report criticizes former FBI Director James Comey's handling of the Clinton investigation. And that was expected. And Democrats will probably harp on that, saying that James Comey hurt Clinton in the election when he publicly announced he was reopening the investigation into her handling of these emails just days before the election occurred. Also, this report reportedly says that there are further previously unknown anti-Donald Trump text messages between two FBI officials, Peter Strzok and Lisa Page, including a statement of trying to stop Trump from becoming president. Now, the Washington Post is also reporting that the Inspector General will not endorse this conspiracy theory from the president and the right that the FBI was trying to undermine Trump's campaign. Nonetheless, we can be sure that the president and his supporters will be talking about this for many days to come. We should say, and I do think it's fair to say, that the investigation into the 2016 election, and I think you can argue it's a valid investigation, an important investigation, but it has also brought to light very questionable practices by this country's law enforcement agencies, including the use of FISA warrants to conduct secret surveillance and also the use of informants. So the president and his supporters, they seem to only have noticed this when it happens to their guy, Donald Trump. They hardly notice and still fail to bring up that such abuses happen on a daily basis against other groups in this country, and in particular over the past 17 years or so against our Muslim community. So there's a long history of this, and today that's what we are going to talk about. We are going to talk about the 1960s and 1970s and the FBI surveillance and infiltration into radical leftist groups during this period. Arthur Eckstein spent years reading declassified documents from the FBI about its investigation into the radical 1970s revolutionary group, the Weather Underground. Earlier this week, he came by and we had a long discussion about what he found. And also, he retold this story that includes bombings of the U.S. Capitol, the Pentagon, and the State Department. Arthur M. Eckstein's a professor of history at the University of Maryland, College Park, and he is the author of the book Bad Moon Rising, How the Weather Underground Beat the FBI and Lost the Revolution. Arthur Eckstein, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Mitch. Glad to be here.
We are going to be talking about the Weather Underground. We're going to be talking about the FBI. Yeah. A lot to talk about here.
Oh, yeah.
There are listeners who are going to know a lot more about the weathermen than I do. There are going to be listeners who don't know very much about who the weathermen are. So let's just start with some of the basics here about, describe for us who the weathermen were.
The weathermen were a group of about 100 people, mostly college students, who began to believe that reform was impossible in the United States, especially after the election of Nixon
in 68.
They were activists, and a lot of them were at the Chicago demonstrations in August of 68.
Leftist activists.
And yeah, they were, and revolutionaries, they would say.
Right.
They were searching. They understood that students were not a big enough social lever to cause revolution. The white working class, which was the traditional group that people were trying to win over for revolution, their analysis, the people around who created weather, their analysis was that's not ever going to happen. And the reason is that people actually are fairly prosperous. Workers are fairly prosperous. It may be crumbs off the table of the rich, but there are still significant crumbs. So there's that. And even more importantly, the white working class is deeply racist. And so they're not going to help the weather, who were close to the Panthers. The weather was a group of about 100 people, and they all got put on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. And a part of the reason that there's even today a legend of Weatherman is actually the FBI publicized them. In every post office in the country in 1970, 71, 72, were the pictures of these people, the Weatherman leaders. I mean, Bill Ayers, Bernardine Dorn, Mark Rudd, a whole bunch of other people. You could say what is strange about the group after it stopped was the number of movies that were made about them.
I remember the first time I heard of the Weather Underground.
When was that?
Not growing up, not as a kid. Mm-hmm. I was really a kid in the 80s. I was born in the 70s, but I never really heard of them until really probably college.
Oh.
And what was remarkable to me when I first heard about the Weather Underground was that they conducted a number of bombings throughout the United States, including, and this is what I found remarkable, of the U.S. Capitol,
yep.
The Pentagon.
That's right. State Department.
State Department.
Yeah. The headquarters of various corporations. The key in the history of Weatherman is that in May 1970, while they were grouped up on the coast north of San Francisco near Sea Ranch, they made a decision, the leaders made a decision not to engage in lethal actions. That they would have call-in, they would telephone, leave plenty of time for people to get out of the targeted building, so that there would not be injuries. Bill Ayers has said, we weren't terrorists, we were arsonists. And there's real truth in that. That if you think of terrorism as intending to kill people in order to make a point, they never did that. And in fact, you can say, why, given that they're small, and given that especially after 1970, they set off a bomb every 6 months or so, why would the FBI make them into such a big cultural issue that films are being made about them as we speak?
I don't know. I imagine if we had a group today setting off a bomb once a month, every 6 months. Or okay, even every 6 months, even every year.
Yeah.
We'd probably make a pretty big deal of it.
Well, and we would, and it would be much more difficult for them to hide.
Yeah.
In 1970, the population of the United States was 220 million. That's 110 million short of where we are now. So there's a lot more space, and especially in upstate New York, which is where a lot of them hit out. And it's very difficult to catch them because for 6 months out of that year, they are leading ordinary lives. They have jobs. They're going to work every day. It's just every 6 months or so, they would get together and build a bomb and place it against an enemy. But is that revolution? No, that's protest. The people who thought that it should be a real revolution understood that that could only occur with blood. So in March of 1970, the townhouse where some weather leaders were staying blew up completely, was completely demolished because of the amount of dynamite they had stored in the townhouse.
This is in Greenwich Village.
In Greenwich Village, yeah.
Yeah.
After that, there was a rethinking about lethal operations.
And the people, so what happened in this townhouse is, my understanding, is they were actually making the bombs.
They were.
And then they went off. The people who died were weather underground members.
That's right, and leaders, and important people. It's kind of amazing that this group of people, who were very young, 21, 22, well, at least that seems young to me.
Yeah, it is young. Yeah. These are young people. Yeah.
And yet they eluded the FBI completely. And I think part of the reason is from March of 1970, they had a constituency. They weren't just a tiny group of terrorists. They were political people, and their constituency, they believed, would be politicized hippies like me. And what you got was this whole issue about killing people. So the Berkeley Tribe in late March of 1970 says, don't do that.
And the Berkeley Tribe is a local paper, an independent.
The most radical paper in the United States. Yeah. Their first issue showed the entire a group of editors and writers and reporters naked. So,
really? The reporters?
Yeah. Everybody. Everybody. Everybody.
Now, I'm sure many of our listeners are like, I knew that, but I didn't know that.
And so the fact that they did not kill anybody resulted actually in the longevity of the group, because nobody was going to turn them in, because nobody felt they were doing anything wrong. And you got a lot of cases where the FBI knocks on the door of somebody and says, we want to talk to you about Weatherman, and the answer is, fuck you. And they have to go away. They don't have a warrant or anything like that. So the FBI never caught a Weatherman. And that's because there's a myth about the FBI, too. In 1970, the FBI had only 8,000 workers, 8,000 agents to cover the United States with 220 million people. There were other issues. Crime was on the rise. There were all that they had to take care of. So that this was an added burden that was put on them by Hoover and by William Sullivan, his second in command, and then by Mark Felt, who replaced Sullivan. And I mean, Felt is a fascinating character. Of course, we now know he was Deep Throat.
He was Deep Throat with the. Yeah.
But boy, he just hated Weatherman. And yet, the power of the counterculture is so strong. Mark Felt had a daughter, Joni, who was at Stanford, and then she decided to join a commune in the Santa Cruz Mountains. Felt flies out. Mark Felt's daughter, Joan. Yeah. And so he flies out to see her to make sure she's okay. And he says, I found her naked in a field nursing a baby, her baby, called Ludo Kohutek, like Comet Kohutek. And, you know, that's a bit of a shock for him. And yet after he retired and after his wife died, he went to live with her, became a vegetarian, and his cholesterol went down by half. And that's one of the other things I would say about that. Even it's not the case that the parents were opposed to them.
And another thing, we were talking about Mark Felt, Deep Throat. What we mean is he was the source for the Washington Post and covering Watergate.
Right.
That we'd learned many years later.
Only in 2005.
Yeah, so still relatively new.
And that's the other part of the story, that if Weatherman has been overblown in the press and helped by the FBI with all those posters. But actually, they're a small group who did protest bombings. The FBI legend is also way, way overblown. They were outmaneuvered and outthought by 100 college kids. I mean, it's just amazing. They spent millions and millions of dollars looking for them, with more and more desperate plans on how to do that. They were going to send Hell's Angels around New England, hoping that the angels would somehow find out where the weather was, and then they would report back to the FBI. You know, that's not a really great tactic. All that's doing is financing people on motorcycles riding around New England. So this was one of the things. The reason that I could write the book was back in 2013, the government released 30,000 pages of FBI memos on Weatherman. And that was a fascinating thing because this is pre-Freedom of Information Act. They never thought that this stuff would ever become public. And then it does. And oddly enough, this material, a lot of it, was gathered for the trial of Mark Felt, who was this deputy second in command of the FBI, and Ed Miller, who was the head of the domestic intelligence branch within the FBI, which is the largest branch. It's the only time that that people connected with Weatherman ever appeared in a federal court. And the people who did were those who were hunting them because they violated the Constitution. They violated the Constitution with warrantless wiretappings and break-ins.
That's what Mark Felt was being prosecuted for?
Yes. He approved it.
What approved what exactly?
Oh, illegal operations. Operations that people knew were illegal, but the argument was the country is in danger, so that enables us to do whatever we want to do. And they got caught doing it. So
what happened to Mark Felt in this trial?
Oh, they were convicted.
They were convicted.
Oh, yeah. And they were convicted of violating the Fourth Amendment in terms of warrantless wiretaps, phone taps, microphones in somebody's house that happened to somebody who was living down near the marina. So
is this after, say, what, the church hearing? When everyone begins to learn about COINTELPRO. And,
right.
Yeah.
Well, I've got a COINTEL operation to talk about that they ran.
Well, let me remind folks who you are. Let me remind folks who you are first before we get into that.
Oh, this is Art Eckstein talking about Bad Moon Rising.
And Art Eckstein is the author of the book, as he just mentioned, Bad Moon Rising, How the Weather Underground Beat the FBI and Lost the Revolution. He's also a professor of history at the University of Maryland. Did you go through all 30,000 of these previously declassified documents?
Well, some of them were easy because everything was blacked out.
Yeah. So still heavily redacted.
They were heavily redacted, yeah. Some were heavily redacted.
So what did you find in these documents?
What did I find? Well, the most important thing and the most shocking thing in these documents is that the FBI helped Weatherman take over Students for a Democratic Society. And we know that because of a long memo that was written in August of 69. The convention had been in June. This is a memo which is boasting about how this was a classic COINTEL operation. And how it worked was the FBI had about 100 civilian informants in SDS. And they told the informants, go to Chicago for the National Convention of SDS, but don't go just to observe. We want you to vote. We want you to vote against progressive labor. We want you to vote in favor of what was then called the Revolutionary Youth Movement One, or sometimes the National Office. But it was Weatherman. All those people were Weatherman. And they'd actually issued the Weatherman manifesto before the conference. But what is simply amazing is this document from August says everything has turned out exactly as we wanted. SDS
this is
split.
From the FBI.
Yes.
The FBI says this is how what this, we wanted.
Yes.
You found that document.
Yes.
You know who wrote it?
Who wrote the memo? It's from the one we have is from the special agent in charge in Cleveland, whose name you don't have to worry about, who was boasting about what they had done, what his guys had done in going to Chicago and playing a part in splitting SDS in half. half going to Progressive Labor, a traditional Marxist-Leninist, and the other half going to weathermen who were much more countercultural. I mean, the people, the PL people, all had crew cuts. They were hard hat people have crew cuts. We don't want to alienate them, and that was a big issue. And PL, and I have to say the SDS contingent at Cal was Progressive Labor. And that's why they didn't support People's Park. They said, oh, that's a hippie thing. We'll never win the working class over by doing things like that.
So these are the two major factions?
These were the two time? Major factions.
And then they're battling it out over the conference, the SDS conference.
Yeah.
Is this 69?
In June of 69 in Chicago, yeah. And things were so bad that people had to be frisked before they went in, frisked for guns. And, I mean, this is a typical Berkeley story. I'm standing in line at Original Pete's to get coffee, and someone comes up to me and says, you wrote that book on weatherman. I said, yes, I did. Well, you ought to talk to the guy behind you. He was in there. And it was true. This guy, Lincoln Payne. So, and he was talking about what it was like to frisk people. He'd been one of the people, you know, the divisions were so sharp that this had happened, that having to frisk people was going on. But I would say, again, the most important thing is, it's not that the FBI created Weatherman. It's not that they were decisive in creating what happened. But to the extent that they could, they supported Weatherman on the grounds that they were less dangerous than Progressive Labor was. That's what the memo says. They're too countercultural. They're not going to do much. While Progressive Labor are these...
we should be much more fearful of them, Progressive Labor, than these counterculture kids.
It was a conflict. And this was, I got involved in this because somebody at the Woodrow Wilson Center said, well, you are a hippie. Why don't you write about this? And I go, oh, I'm tenured. I can do whatever the hell I want. It's one of the great advantages of tenure. So I just started working on what had just come out in the archives. Yeah. And if I hadn't gotten that phone call from William Roger Lewis, who's a famous student of the British Empire, if I hadn't have gotten that phone call, the book wouldn't exist. But once they started, I said, oh, my youth, yes, let's go back and visit my youth of so long ago. It's going to be, it was then 45 years now, it's going to be 50. When I went up to the National Archives and opened the doors, these guys bring out truckloads of material. Now, as someone who mostly does ancient history, though I've also written on American film and all kinds of other stuff, to see these carts coming out with information, this is just astounding. Two carts.
In English.
In English, not in
probably
Latin.
Probably easier than Latin.
Not in Latin or Greek, no, not in Latin or Greek. And so I was able to spend about 2 years reading those documents. I could do that because I wasn't under pressure to publish. I already published a lot of stuff. And I had tenure, and I could do this. I went where the muse pushed me, which was to look at this stuff. And this is the most important thing, I think, in the book, that the split that occurred in June of 69 in Chicago, which destroyed SDS, split into two sides, was facilitated secretly by the FBI itself. On the grounds that Weatherman were less dangerous than Progressive Labor. That was a miscalculation. They were more dangerous than Progressive Labor. Progressive Labor believed that the revolution could only occur once you'd won over the white working class. Well, that's going to take a long time. Weatherman's position was the role of a revolutionary is to create and make the revolution. Don't, you know, if we kill enough cops... Their argument was, and soldiers, the masses will see the problem and come over to us. That's what they thought. That's what they thought. And it was based on a revolutionary philosophy by Regis Debray, who had been with Che Guevara in his last campaign before he was captured and killed. Anyway, so you had that split, but that split would have occurred no matter what. But it is a fascinating thing that the FBI helped Weatherman get control of SDS. That's really striking. And some people at the time had wondered about that.
We always see this. I've always seen this within leftist groups that are active. I saw it in Occupy. I think we see it in every mm-hmm. example. And then you get infighting. We get it here at this radio station, sure. too. A great deal of infighting, and then there's always that suspicion, probably from all sides, right?
Why do you think that occurs?
I think some of it is real. I think a lot of it's real. I think it's mm-hmm. natural. I think throughout history,
yeah.
you put a bunch of leftists in the room, they're going to go at each other.
That's absolutely true that they did. Why do you think that is?
I think it's because we are, in a sense, I'm unprepared to answer this, but on the yeah. spot, maybe that we are idealists, thinking and believe in what we're pushing for, to the point of, you know, do we compromise or not? And sometimes we don't.
Yeah, I mean, that's the issue.
There's egos, there's power struggles. I mean, I'm sure it's not just on the left, but...
No, but it's strong on the left. Yeah. There are two parts of it. Ideologically, if you have the wrong ideology and try to create a revolution, you're going to lose. So having the correct analysis is what counts. And that's what the debate was between Weatherman and PL. And especially Weatherman said, yeah, we don't have the white working class. They're hopelessly corrupt. They vote for fascists. They are fascists and racists. We can't have them. And so they turned to the Panthers. And there were Panthers at the Chicago demonstration as guests to talk. So the idea is that, yeah, the FBI did what it could to wreck things. They're a factor in it. But it's not wrong to say that the FBI told their informants, vote for Weatherman
yeah.
on every issue.
So they played a role.
And yeah.
yeah.
And it's a classic COINTELPRO operation that was done. And I think Weather people that I know are shocked that this happened. And the answer is they were penetrated. They were totally penetrated because they were a big organization.
Which, looking back on it now, is not yeah. so surprising. I mean, they
no.
penetrated everything.
They had. And I talked about this with the counterintelligence officer of the African National Congress. And he said, you know, Weatherman's security was perfect. The FBI never was able to penetrate them, except this one guy. That was over by early 1970. They were completely free. He said, well, that kind of security is certainly admirable, but the result was there were only 100 people and they really didn't do that much. And he said, we in the African National Congress believed in having the largest or above ground organization you could. And he said that meant that there were going to be people who were civilian informants for the South African government. And he says to me, that's the price of doing business. That's the price of doing business.
You just have to expect that's going
to happen. You have to expect it, yeah.
I guess it begs the question, though, if the FBI did penetrate the Weather Underground, then how did the Weather Underground still get away with these and were able to perform these bombings?
Well, that's certainly part of the legend, is that they attacked really important symbolic targets.
U.S. Capitol. Pentagon.
U.S. Capitol, right. The Pentagon,
State
where they actually were able to stop the bombing for a week because the bomb went off in the bathroom, but right below it was the computer that handled air operations, telling people where to go, coordinating this.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So they said, what, the bombing in Vietnam?
Yes.
Cambodia?
Laos. Of course. Yes. Yes, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos.
Uh-huh.
And of course, that was the huge issue, too. You say, why did this happen? Why did you get this kind of trajectory to the farther and farther left and vanguard partyism and all of that stuff? And the answer was the war, which in 1969 looked like it was escalating, not de-escalating, especially with Cambodia. And racism had not been changed. That was their view. So how they eluded the FBI for 7 years is they were smart. And the FBI is not as great as people think. It's made up, it's still not that large. There's about 13,000 agents now for 330 million people. People talk about a police state, but a police state would be this. The German Democratic Republic, East Germany, where about a quarter of the entire population were either suspected and had files or were civilian informants. And after the wall came down and those records got in the hands of people. I mean, some people found that their wife was a civilian informant or their husband was a civilian informant. I mean, it was just, but the number of, so we're talking about in East Germany, a population of 15 million, we're talking about 45,000 agents plus civilian informants. And by 1989, it's 90,000 agents versus 13,000 here or 8,000 in back in 1970. It's a quantitatively different situation. That doesn't mean that people weren't thinking this is fascism, it's going to take over, we have to, that's why we have to pick up the gun. And many people had guns in Berkeley in 69 and 70.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Tom Hayden had
a gun. Tom Hayden had a gun.
Yeah.
We are in conversation with Arthur Eckstein. Arthur Eckstein is a professor of history at the University of Maryland College Park. We're talking about his book, Bad Moon Rising, How the Weather Underground Beat the FBI and Lost the Revolution. This book was actually plugged by Tom Hayden, who died within the past year or so. Even a farther back.
That's right. And you can read what he says about the FBI in the blurb for the book. Like Hayden writes, this is a book about the FBI's signature blend of bureaucratic incompetence combined with contempt for civil liberties.
So he enjoyed your book. He liked your book.
Let me tell you about that.
How about Weather Underground members?
Well, let me tell you about Tom.
Yeah.
In chapter one of the book, I'm critical of him for believing that the townhouse was simply a rogue operation by a bunch of crazies. And I said he had accepted that in several books when he talked about it. That was the history, which is a false history. And I criticize him in the book, and he writes a blurb anyway. A very nice blurb.
But that he still disagreed with you reading it.
Yeah. But he said it's an interesting book.
And the narrative is at the townhouse that where the bombs exploded, several Weather Underground members were killed, Weather Underground people were killed. That, again, it was just some sort of a freak accident.
Right. That was the argument that was used. Or that particular group, that particular collective went crazy, and they made Terry Robbins, who was the leader of that group, into a scapegoat. And what the FBI stuff shows is that on that day, March 6th in 1970, it wasn't only going to be New York and the attack on, actually they were planning to attack the Fort Dix non-commissioned officers dance. And there are reasons to be angry at Fort Dix. That's really true. But in Chicago and Detroit, it's actually Detroit, the weatherman planned to blow up the headquarters of the retired police building, as well as placing bombs in the precinct house of the 13th District, which was where the men were who had done Algiers Motel incident when black people were just shot down by the cops. So Weather in Detroit wanted to take advantage of that, and they built bombs, and those bombs were scheduled to go off on the same day, and one result would have been, because of one, and we're talking about a lot of dynamite, 10 sticks of dynamite against the side of the Police Officers Association building, 30 sticks of dynamite in Precinct 13 headquarters. And you say, well, how could they do that? How could they get in? This is pre-searching for weapons and metal detectors.
Yeah.
They don't exist. I mean, this was true in the Pentagon. How they did the Pentagon was they sent in a woman with a purse with the tons of civilian employees that go into the Pentagon every morning at 8. She wasn't questioned because nobody believed that anything was going to happen to them. And she found where to place the bomb in the women's restroom. She left. The next day, she comes back with the bomb in her hands, in her purse. In her purse. No security. I mean, you couldn't do that now.
No, absolutely
no.
Not.
Yeah. But those days were, in a way, fundamentally innocent. And it was true of the bombing of the Capitol, too. And the bombing of the Capitol, it's a Keystone Cops story. They set up the bomb, a dynamite bomb, to go off in the Pentagon, in the Capitol, a big symbolic act. They then issued a communique, ha-ha, we bombed the Capitol, and the bomb didn't go off.
It never went off.
No. And they went back in with another bomb and placed it on top of the first one.
Wait, so they already announced that they had bombed, it didn't go off, then they went back and did it again?
Yeah.
And this time it did go off.
It did go off, yeah. But I mean...
No one noticed? What?
it is totally... Here's another example.
Wait. I want to know about the Capitol one a little more. Where in the Capitol? Where did this happen?
It was in a men's room in one of the, I guess, the house wing.
On the house wing? Yeah. Or like an office building across the street or on the actual
No, it was the Capitol.
Yeah.
You know, an 18th century, early 19th century building.
Uh-huh.
That's what they were going to do. But I think the thing to understand is that the townhouse was not a freak accident, that it was going to be a triple event on March 6th, one big bomb in Fort Dix, and two, one with 10 sticks of dynamite, the other one in the 13th District Police Headquarters was 30 sticks of dynamite. It would have leveled the building. And in those days, and you know, it's pretty amazing. And one has to say that the leader of the Detroit Collective was Bill Ayers. And the Detroit Collective had the last remaining civilian informant, Larry Grathwall. And he saw what was going on. He went to the police and said, "Here's where the bombs are going to go off. And we have the memos, and we went there, and there were the bombs." And it wasn't set by Grathwall, who by that time was far away. He was on another assignment they'd been given by Ayers. But that suggests, and in fact, people say in the book, people who know say, there was no such thing as a rogue operation in Weatherman. It was all centrally controlled by the Central Committee, which was called the Weather Bureau. And that means that these were going to be, the revolution was going to start with this terrible triple event in which, I mean, there would have been plenty of civilians who would have been killed in Detroit in both bombings. It just would have happened. That's how much the townhouse is not a rogue operation. It just isn't. It's everybody knew it in New York. I mean, Mark Rudd told me he went to a movie. He went to see Zabriskie Point in order to establish his own alibi for when that happened, and to which he said, of course, that's the only reason anybody would ever want to go to see that movie, is a risky point. So it was a really that would have been a terrible thing if this had happened, because Nixon would have declared martial law, and then you would have a real revolutionary thing.
Now, Bill Ayers nor Bernadine Dorn, they're married. They also went underground and lived underground for a while. Been on this radio program several times now together. Uh-huh. Been always been very kind to me. They would not talk to you.
No, about they wouldn't. This book. I did talk to Jeff Jones and Eleanor Stein, who were all two members of the Weather Bureau, and what happened actually. That stopped this cycle going towards killing was, first, the townhouse explosion was really traumatic for people, and what they the Detroit thing didn't go off at all because it was caught by the cops. In one case, the bomb was within 10 seconds of going off. That's in Detroit. But at what had happened was Bernadine Dorn and Jeff Jones, living in California, Jeff Jones is a California guy, were very affected by the counterculture. And at this meeting, they said, "We can't kill. If the Berkeley Tribe, the most radical underground newspaper in the country, is writing editorials saying, 'Do not kill.' It says, 'If you kill, you will be alone. If you don't kill, lots of people will support you.'"
Was the Berkeley Tribe alone?
No. Yeah. Ramparts also, Tom Hayden wrote a thing in Ramparts in that period saying the U.S. is not a third world country. You don't have the support of the working class. You should not do this. And this was also the view of the Vietnamese and the Cubans. They said, "We're Marxist-Leninists. We're looking at the social structure of the United States. It's not ripe for revolution. Don't do it." And they were ignored I mean, the advice...
The Vietnamese government?
The Vietnamese, they a bunch of weather leaders met in Havana in the summer of 1969, and they met with people from the NLF, from the Viet Cong, and North Vietnamese people too, and then the Cubans also. And the Vietnamese and the Cubans said, no, what we want are mass demonstrations, not bombs in bathrooms. And certainly the mass demonstrations, both in 67 and 69, the big mobilizations, had an impact first on Johnson and then on Nixon, which was they couldn't escalate as much as they want. We didn't know that. We thought what we had done was worthless. Yeah, we had a good time, and every saw all the people who were really angry, but what's the good of the march? And then it turns out it's really important. So if we want to change the government, having massive marches is a good idea to do it.
But at the time, it doesn't seem like it's working. Like you said, at the time, it doesn't seem like it's working.
You're young,
and you feel this sense of desperation to stop it. There are people that are being killed overseas.
Right. And you get Antifa, which is the same as weather in a lot of ways. The Antifa people. And they're way off on one wing. But for weather, I would say, those weather people are our people. Yeah, they're wild, but they are ours. And
I say the same with Antifa.
Yeah.
There are people too. I mean,
right.
People may not be happy with what they do, but
and there are you could say they're necessary. The Panther people always said, "You don't like us? Well, it's either us or real terrorism."
Right.
Right. And, I mean, that's an interesting thing. Also, let me just say also about the Panthers. These documents were secret documents. They weren't supposed to be seen in public. And the one from 1970 about trying to establish a Homeland Security thing says, we have not been able to penetrate Panther leadership. We haven't been able to turn anybody. We've got people in the ordinary soldiers kind of thing, but not in the leadership. And this is the thing, too. The Panthers were able to do that, and Weatherman was able to do that. The FBI is not all-powerful. They live on a myth. And you can say one of the things they did...
Also shows how serious these groups were.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know,
these were revolutionary groups.
They
may have not brought the revolution, right. But...
And I mean, one of the other things, one of the slanders that has been made about Weather is that they were just a bunch of rich kids on a lark. And that's just not true either. They were, as Mark Rudd said to me, we're all intellectuals. We have a theory. And the Ron Fliegelman, who was important, says to me, I built some bombs because I was the only person, I'm surrounded by hopeless intellectuals. I was the only one who could use my hands to do stuff. So I'm the person that they chose to do it.
I had a neighbor who I was doing laundry
this
past weekend.
Yeah.
Had your book with me in the laundromat getting ready for this. He asked me what I was reading. I told him, he said, are these the rich white kids who bomb places?
Ayers was wealthy. Diana Oaten was wealthy. John Jacobs sort of was. But the vast majority of people came from the middle class or lower. The SDS leader in Seattle... His father had abandoned him and his mother. The father was an alcoholic. The mother worked as a soda jerk in some place. And that was poverty all along the line. It's the ideology that counts. You can have sort of false sociology where it says, well, they're in the townhouse. Yeah, the townhouse is worth $1 million. It's a huge building filled with antiques. That's true. But it's also true that the owner of the townhouse... Kathy Wilkerson's father was alienated from her for stuff that went back a long way from her mother and said, yeah, you can stay here for 2 weeks, but don't bring your scruffy friends with you. Except she did. But they happened to be in the townhouse. They happened to be in a spiffy part of Greenwich Village. That's not where people in Weatherman usually hung out, which was in poverty-stricken areas.
Yeah.
So the rich kids on a lark is just ridiculous. It is, they were ideology rich.
Arthur Eckstein, as we move to wrap up here, you're a historian of the ancient world. So let me ask you, what do you think the historic legacy of the weathermen is? Do you think, and we're projecting here, but do you think they're remembered down the road?
I think, well, certainly for 100 years, they'll be remembered. After that, who knows?
History fades oftentimes.
Yeah, but they'll be remembered because the FBI made them celebrities. This was, by the way, a typical FBI operation. You have a big target. You create a big target. If it's not really a target, you create a big target, and then you catch them, and you look great. That's what they did with the...
That's the strategy?
Yes, that's the strategy in terms of public relations.
So they did with, like, Dillinger and...
They did Dillinger. They did all kinds of...
Make them look like blow up their image and their fierceness and their fearsomeness.
Right.
And
so people are afraid of them.
And then you capture them and now you are the...
But, I mean, the mood of the country was such that... So FBI people come to knock on somebody's door, somebody that I know. And they say, "We're looking for your husband." And she says from inside the door, "I have 1,000 husbands. I'm not talking to you." And they had to go away. But they also did illegal things. They did many illegal things. And I would say, the left has suddenly fallen in love with the FBI. I think that's wrong. They were bad in 1970, and they do the same now. Let me give you an example of this. You know the story about Mateen's widow, the guy, the Orlando shooter's widow, was on trial as an accessory to terrorism. After the prosecution was finished, the defense is handed a piece of paper that says, "By the way, Mateen's father was a civilian informant for the FBI for 10 years before he did that, including right before he did the Orlando shooting." How come he didn't notice what his son was doing? You know, the tentacles are all over the place, but they are not, they're small, they're overworked, they're overwhelmed, and they cut corners. They did in the 70s, and I think they still do.
Well, I think this new love affair with the FBI, I wouldn't say it's all the left. But there is this idea that this is an entity that's, since President Trump is denouncing the FBI because the FBI investigation into the election.
Right.
I'd also look at Republicans and say, well, it's good now that you are concerned about such things as FISA courts and informants and all these things. However, you didn't care at all because these things have been rubber stamped. These FISA warrants have been rubber stamped for years.
Absolutely.
And always towards young Muslim men that they were entrapping.
Yeah.
But now that it's their guy, their president, they care. But they don't care about this other stuff.
No, and I would warn left people not to get in bed with the FBI, not to support them, not to praise them. They're hitting targets that we like them to hit. But it's this. But their methods are the same kind of things that were going on 50 years ago. I wish it wasn't so, but the Mateen thing... What happened to the Mateen thing was that they get this, "Oh, by the way, Mateen's father was an FBI informant," after the prosecution has finished its case, so they can't go back and cross-examine people. But there was enough for the jury to acquit her. The judge was really angry when that came out. And this is how Weatherman survived. The FBI was involved in illegal operations against them in 70, 71, 72, 73. The judge who was going to try the bombing people if they were caught asked the FBI in June of 1973, "Has any of the information for this trial, if it ever comes, been collected illegally?" And the answer they got back, the answer the judge got back, Damon Pierce, was, "Everything's legal." It's just a damn lie.
Right.
And then when Watergate really opened up, Pierce asks again, and the answer from the FBI is, "They dropped the charges against all of those people. They are free from federal threat because of what also is going on." So I guess to sum it up, I mean, let me say also, I know a lot of weather people. They are really fine people. They're thoughtful, self-critical, They've done many good things around the country. They're living in peace, which they vowed they never would, but in fact they are. One can say about that, because they were white, and this is something else, Weatherman was 100% white. Because they were white and middle class, there was always a bridge for them to come back to society, not like the Panthers with 29 dead. No weatherman was ever injured by anybody from the cops. No one was ever caught. So there's that issue of competence. But I'd also say, if they cut corners, the left shouldn't be in a position of celebrating people who cut corners constitutionally.
As you said, the Panthers weren't so lucky. Still have people in jail today.
Yeah.
Arthur Eckstein, thank you.
Okay, this was fun.
Again, Arthur M. Eckstein has been our guest. He is a professor of history and distinguished scholar teacher, and also distinguished university professor at the University of Maryland, College Park. He is the author of the book, Bad Moon Rising, How the Weather Underground Beat the FBI and Lost the Revolution. And that does it for Letters and Politics. The show is produced by Deanna Martinez. Kristen Thomas is our engineer. You can find archives of our previous shows online at kpfa.org. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and I thank you for listening.
It's time for the news at noon for Monday, June 18th, 2018. Earlier this morning, President Trump attacked German Chancellor Angela Merkel via Twitter, criticizing Germany's open immigration border policies, writing, quote, "The people of Germany are turning against their leadership as migration is rocking the already tenuous Berlin coalition." He continued, saying, "Crime in Germany is way up," and added, "Big mistake made all over Europe in allowing millions of people in who have strongly and violently changed their culture. We don't want what is happening with immigration in Europe to happen with us." Presently, Merkel is in a policy standoff with her interior minister over new immigration restrictions. She faces a two-week deadline to find a European solution or risk the collapse of her governing coalition. President Trump's tweets come at a time when his own administration is under fire for implementing what some consider unlawful and even immoral immigration laws in the U.S. and at the Mexican border.